It's the Certified Organic Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Zoophilia, Lincoln the Movie, and What Makes Organic Organic. Let's begin episode 192.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. You know, Ethan, it's been a hard couple of weeks for the culinary minded. We've found out that, you know, we're losing such great things like coffee and shellfish and hell, even the Twinkies are on the endangered list.
Poor Twinkie.
Yes. And now it's the end of the truffle. Well, the black truffle. The best truffle in the world, I think, are the black truffles. That's the one you normally think of when you think of truffles and soup and all that sort of thing. Prices can reach over $5,000 a kilo, so not cheap things to get. Well, it seems that climate change is destroying another culinary icon.
Hmm.
The truffle harvest used to be upwards of 1,000 tons a year, but currently a good year, you only get about 25 tons, which I guess is a lot of truffle, but a lot less than they used to get. Swiss scientists think they know why. They stated in a letter to the journal Nature Climate Change that data clearly shows that drier summers are to blame, and this affects the oak and hazelnut trees to which the prized fungus live, and they have sort of a symbiotic relationship with it that, you know, I'll help you, you help me, and us humans get really, really tasty food. They compared the rate of harvest in France and Spain, where the forests are much more sensitive to rain variation, to that of northern Italy, where there's heavier rain, so it's much more consistent as far as how much rain falls. They found that although truffles harvests were lower everywhere, they were much, much worse in the areas that were affected by climate change-driven drought. So add to this a new climate model showing that temperatures could rise three times more than originally thought, with an average climate change of 9 degrees, and, well, who knows what's next on the list?
This is really tragic. I mean, a huge staple of our diet is slowly being ebbed away. I mean, fish, truffles, Twinkies. I mean, what are we going to eat? Like vegetables or something?
You know, it's going down that way, and you know, I mean, on the serious point, I mean, this shows that it actually has real effects. But on the other thing, you know, you're right. Pretty soon, we might be just forced to eat gruel all the time, and it's like, thank you, sir. May I have another?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have a great show today. Not only do we have interesting things to discuss, we have one of our rarely seen but always fascinating movie reviews. Ooh. Here on CITR and Radio Free Thinker. So this past weekend, I happened to see the new film Lincoln, directed by Steven Spielberg. a very impressive film, if I don't say so myself. High quality acting, really gripping political drama. But of course the question is, and I'm sure many people would like to hear, is it historically accurate, or was Mr. Spielberg spinning tall tales of the myth of Lincoln?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't he alter it so that Lincoln actually ended up being killed by Jaws or something?
Well, not quite that bad. It wasn't quite along the same lines as sort of the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter movie that came out a little while ago. But there was some small things here and there that were a little bit off. Now, full disclosure, I am out of date when it comes to American Civil War history. There was a time when I knew the timeline of Civil War, Emancipation, Reconstruction by heart, but that was years ago. So I took a quick look around what other historians are saying and what I remember, and I'd like to sort of synthesize that collection of knowledge. And so if any listeners are wondering, here's sort of what the consensus seems to be. And also, another caveat, normally I would prevent spoilers from going out there. But considering the subject matter, and I think most people know sort of the story arc here.
The plot twist at the end.
Yeah. So I'm not going to worry too much about that. If you write to me complaining about spoilers, I will laugh at you later. So anyway, let's start with the overall verdict.
We could say we've just given a spoiler alert anyhow. So
yeah, fine, fair
overall.
Enough. Overall,
let's get started.
Overall verdict: I think that history buffs should rest easy. This is, in fact, a entertaining and reasonably accurate story about Lincoln. The crux of the movie is about passing the 13th Amendment over the course of, like, you know, the 3 weeks that it was sort of being debated. There's a few potential problems that come along with portraying Lincoln, and the main issue is, how do you portray the man himself? Because we know the common view of him is sort of this really pious, saintly man who was very enlightened and, you know, cared so much about everybody, and he passed this amendment because he just knew it was the right thing to do, goddammit. Unfortunately, history tells us that's not really what Lincoln was like.
What?
Lincoln was, by all accounts, one of the most astute politicians of his time. This man knew what it took to get things done, and he did it. And that's how he's portrayed in the film. He is not this... I mean, he comes across to the people of the other characters as sort of this brilliant man, but he portrays himself as an astute politician. Some might even say scheming. And this Lincoln is a political genius and not so much the sort of enlightened avatar that we kind of have portrayed him in the past.
Maybe Machiavellian genius?
Actually, there is a scene where there is a bit of megalomania coming through in Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, which is, quite frankly, very worth the admission right there. The film is based on the book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln by Doris Kearns Goodwin, which I haven't read the book, but I understand it got very high reviews when it first came out. And the focus, like I said, is passing the 13th Amendment early in Lincoln's second term before the Civil War ends. The concern is that if the war ends, the Emancipation Proclamation will be rescinded. And so the drama of the film is, can Lincoln get the 13th Amendment passed before the South surrenders? And if the South decides to surrender, that undermines all his support. Keeping in mind that Lincoln was of the Republican Party, which back then was on the political left. The Democrats were on the political right.
Well, and it also emphasized the point that although we tend to think of the Confederacy as these slave states, there were three or four slave states that were still part of the Union. I think, Kentucky, Maryland, and Tennessee? No, not Tennessee.
But you are...
Yeah, so, yeah. So the fact that, you know, we want to emancipate people as a strike against the South had a political cost in the North, because there were some states that said, hey, we stayed with you, what the hell are you doing?
Exactly. And so Lincoln's adversaries in this film are the Democrat Party, which mostly is portrayed as sort of conservative, obviously against the South, but they want to see peace, and they don't care about slavery. Then there's the conservative branch of the Republican Party, also that wants peace. Obviously, they're of Lincoln's party, but then there's the radical Republicans, led by Thaddeus Stevens, played by Tommy Lee Jones, who want to abolish slavery, and they're more sort of what we would consider far left for the time. They had really radical ideas about like land reform and everything like that.
There's actually another issue that plays into this, and you tell me if the movie goes this, but there's a big issue of this idea of states' rights, and that's one of the differences is the Democrats were actually strong believers, I believe, at the time in the idea of states' rights. So although they didn't like slavery anymore maybe than the Republicans did in practice, they said, well, it's the state's right to decide, and if they want to secede, that's their business, whereas the Republicans were much more of we're one nation, undivided.
Yeah, that does come through in the film as well. And Lincoln even has a really interesting speech where he discusses what would happen if they didn't pass the 13th Amendment, because the legal mumbo-jumbo of the Emancipation Proclamation becomes really muddied when you think of it. Are they traitors? Are they American citizens? If they're traitors, do they have rights under American law? But if they're American citizens, then Lincoln can't just proclaim something like this without going through Congress. So it's really messy. It's really interesting for fans of political intrigue. So some of the things that might rankle historians, there's the typical historic bloopers that are always present in films like this. There's one point where Lincoln uses a crank to raise a flag when he should have been using ropes. You know, small things like that. There's some invented dialogue, especially with Lincoln. He says a few progressively minded things that really there's no evidence that he ever would have said that in real life, which is kind of, I mean, it is a film. It's drama, right?
Like what?
Well, he makes a claim about the future of slavery if left unconquered, referring to we would be consigning millions of unborn people to slavery. And these are sort of lines and things that Lincoln at the time in real life like never really brought up, concerned him that much, which is interesting. I mean, there is some debate about how progressive Lincoln really was and, you know, what was all political gamesmanship. Now, there's also no mention whatsoever of Lincoln's disastrous vice president and racist drunk, Andrew Johnson, which is kind of interesting. The 13th Amendment is also presented as Lincoln's invention, which is, of course, incorrect. The 13th Amendment was proposed in 1864 by the Women's National Loyal League, led by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And at the time, Lincoln didn't support it when they brought it to him. Additionally, there's one of the things that I found personally kind of irritating was that we historians know for a long time that slavery was not just defeated in the halls of Congress, that it was defeated by slaves themselves. When Sherman was carving a bloody path through the South, they were liberating slaves who were seizing plantations, dividing land, working for themselves, building communities, and they played a major role in establishing the precedent for freedom and that sort of thing. And likewise, you had former slaves like Frederick Douglass and others who were lobbying and appealing for freedom long before the 13th Amendment. And I think the biggest omission in the film is that there's no mention of Douglass anywhere, and that seems very strange to me.
Yeah, especially about a movie that's centered along the idea of black rights to have one of the most powerful African-Americans not in it.
Well, that's interesting because in a film about emancipation, there were only about three or four speaking roles for black characters, which is, again, kind of like, you know, you think that Spielberg could have found a spot somewhere to put in, like, Frederick Douglass or something.
Well, I imagine this must be one of the hard areas that you do as a producer and a director and all that sort of thing. Because on the one hand, I mean, there were not that many, major political people who happened to be African-American origin because it was a racist sort of country.
Yeah.
Even in the places that didn't have slavery, they still were deeply racist. So in that sense, it's quite accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But in the other sense, it kind of goes against the whole theme of the movie.
Yeah, there was a scene early on where Lincoln was talking with some soldiers, and two black soldiers. One of them was very, like, you know, very fawning over Lincoln, loved him, you know, wanted to shake his hand. The other soldier was very direct and said, you know, I don't know if you realize this, but we get paid $3 less than white soldiers, even though we're fighting, and we have to buy our own boots, and it was very sort of like, it kind of felt like you could have said the same thing almost to Steven Spielberg, you know, like in a movie about emancipation, really, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's good that there was that acknowledgement of the fact that, you know, this was ultimately about freedom for people, and they're hardly represented in the movie, which is like you said, it's hard to strike that balance. The only other major issue that I felt could have been mentioned was the premise for Lincoln trying to pass the 13th Amendment under the, quote, threat of peace breaking out is kind of unrealistic in the sense that the South at that time realistically wasn't looking to surrender. There were peace delegations, but they were still talking about, you know, a separate nation peace, which, of course, was not going to happen. So that was kind of an invention of the filmmakers, but it added some drama. And obviously, this is not a documentary. It's meant to entertain and inspire, and it does do that.
Well, and it also plays into the idea that this was actually one of the weapons that Lincoln had used in the war with foreign nationals, right? I mean, like Britain and France, and those were kind of sitting back on the side. And Britain especially wanted to have slavery made illegal, because that was the moral argument that would win with them. Because, I mean, they'd obviously seen other nations who want to rule themselves. Heck, that's how the United States itself came into being. So, So they were kind of wanting to support the southern states in the sense that, well, one, you have cotton, which we need, so their economic interest. We do kind of recognize your right to self-rule. But you have this slavery thing, and England had already outlawed slavery at home, and I think a little later in the colonies. Until the United States actually came out and said, listen, slavery is now illegal in this country, Britain was kind of, well, we could go for either one of you guys.
Yeah, that's very true. And the Lincoln's ability to sort of navigate that minefield was part of what made him, you know, arguably one of the greatest presidents for America, because it would have been very easy for him to say, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll make concessions to France or England as long as you send over some troops. And he didn't do that. And I think that was kind of interesting. I mean, on the other hand, you look at the casualty list of the Civil War and you go, maybe he should have done that. Again, fascinating movie. I encourage all skeptics to check it out.
And it's such a shame that with all this fawning glory you've given to him, he screwed it all up by having Andrew Johnson as his vice president. And when he died, almost everything that Lincoln had moved to make the United States better, he just said, screw it, let's go back to the way it was before.
Yeah, oh, Johnson. Oh, my. Probably the one of the best presidents, followed by one of the absolute worst presidents. Really, really depressing, actually.
Quite.
Well, let's go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
A center for ants!
What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit citr.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
And we're back. So, we're going to talk about zoophilia. Well, actually, before we go that, I'm going to tell you, you know, it's funny when you come across a story and you say, yeah, so what? And then you read a little bit more and something makes you go, what? And then, of course, you start to question some of your assumptions and that sort of thing. Now, I don't expect anyone to have their minds or views changed by this, but I thought it might be interesting to sort of challenge our dogmatic, that's funny, you'll understand why later, or something that we sort of have as instinctive gut reactions. Now, you may be asking yourself, what the hell are you talking about, Don? Well, let me tell you. We love our pets, some more vigorously than others, and that's disgusting, or so seems to be the sentiment from Germany, where the law of animal love is changing. Bestiality, or its more PC title, zoophilia, was removed from the German Penal Code in 1969, and since then, it's only been against the law if you significantly harm an animal, if you, you know, do the deed with it. So chicken sex is out, but everything else pretty much in. The act was no longer, the act will no longer depend on whether or not harm is inflicted, but rather whether the animal is forced to commit, quote, actions alien to the species, according to the draft legislation. The legislation will make zoophilia punishable by a fine of up to about $32,000. Ouch. A spokesman for the agricultural ministry told the told that the government regulations were intended to sort of clarify the legal position. With the explicit ban, it will be easier to impose penalties and to improve, quote, animal protection. The president of ZETA, Zoophile Engagement for Tolerance and Information, a group representing people who engage in act of zoophilia, said that they would take legal actions. What? There's a group about this? And I was reading about this the first time. I'm going, well, okay, it's a little odd and there's some strings. But to sit there and there's a whole a national organization, and not only is it a national organization for sort of support, but it's a national organization that feels comfortable enough to come out and said, hey, we're going to challenge this new legislation. And he's the president of ZETA said, it is unthinkable that any sexual act with an animal is punished without proof that the animal has come to harm. We see animals as partners, not as means of gratification. We don't force them to do anything. Again, I'm sure you've asked, but did they actually say yes? Or, you know, does moo mean no? Yeah, okay, bad joke. sex with animals has been banned, actually, in a number of European countries, including France, Switzerland, and even the liberal Netherlands. Sweden is preparing a ban, but it's actually legal in a lot of places. So Denmark, Belgium, Brazil, Japan, Finland, and a number of the other states. And speaking of states, from my research, which may be flawed because the laws are a little dicey here, it is legal in Alabama, Hawaii, Montana, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico. A lot of the new places like having sex with animals. Ohio, Texas, Vermont, West Virginia, Wyoming. It's not legal in Canada, though. I was kind of hoping it would be like, you know, Alabama, Georgia, West Virginia, you know, just the typical southern sort of, but it didn't. In most cases, the sexual partner is likely to be a dog because that's the one we most commonly have around us now. But in the olden days, when people lived on farms, it was cows, horses, sheep, goats, and pigs, according to Deliverance, mainly pigs. ZETA pointed out to research done in the 1940s that suggests that anywhere from 5 to 8% of men and about 3 to 5% of women engage in zoophilia. However, Quake, the president of ZETA, said that that would put the current figure in Germany about 1.6 million, and he thinks that's really, really too high. He said that, taking a wild guess, he figured there'd be about over 100,000 people or so who engage in such activities. Now, of course, That was the sort of the ha-ha-ha funny part, right? These people are weird. But they did bring out something that I thought was actually quite interesting to discuss. ZETA criticized the planned legal amendment because it still didn't ban things like unanesthetized castration of piglets in the meat processing industry, branding of horses. He also mentioned that the farm industry sexually abuses animals in the sense that, you know, they allow breeders to stick, quote, electrified rods up the backsides of boars to make them ejaculate so they can fertilize other pigs. And they tie up mares so they can be mounted by stallions. So when I first heard this, right, I mean, I went, ha, weird sort of thing. But then they did kind of have a point. I mean, if there's no harm coming to the animal, does it really need to be made illegal? And I mean, there are other issues that come in this, but Ethan, and I know this is going to be delicate for you because you have a pet owner and I don't want you to cross any bounds one way or the other, but what do you think about this, both on a gut reaction and on the second sort of skeptical second thought?
Well, I mean, I think the main issue, especially relating to the last point about sort of the way animals are treated, for food or whatever, I think that argument doesn't really hold up too well because there are people who do make the claim, and perhaps justifiably so, that we shouldn't even be doing that to animals. We shouldn't even be eating them. We shouldn't be breeding them. That's a form of animal cruelty. And I mean, I'm obviously in favor of not being cruel to animals. Who would be in favor of that? So I'm sympathetic to that argument that our modern way of preparing animals for food is not humane. But you can't really have a way to prepare an animal for food that's humane, as far as I can think of. I mean, if you're killing something and eating it, it's not going to be humane.
True, but there you actually. I mean, one could say that if you're killing the animal, harm is being done, and these people are claiming, well, I'm not actually hurting the animal, and for the sake of the argument, we're going to say, okay, so you're not actually hurting the animal. I guess, because I was talking to this with some other people that I know, and they brought up, well, you know, it's against God. You know, they brought up the religious sense of morality. And I think that was one of the wording bothered me in this is acts alien to the species is, I mean, that's a very broad definition that could be used against anything. Again, most notably in our current thing, homosexuality, which is often labeled as unnatural.
Yeah. Well, and that was sort of also ties in because of the whole slippery slope argument people would make. If you let gays get married, what's next? You're going to let people marry rabbits or something like that. And again, I think that perhaps a way of thinking about it, as opposed to sort of the alien of the species type thing, is to think about it in terms of not just risk to the animal, but also risk to the population. I mean, there are certain dangerous aspects about crossbreeding human and animal life, especially farm animals, because we know that that's a very big vector for disease right there. You could be potentially exposing yourself or others around you to even more harmful pathogens. I'm not really sure if there's a way to have safe sex with an animal in the first place.
Yeah, no, the only unsafe sex I came across was a guy in Washington who apparently had intercourse with a horse that was slightly larger than his capacity to handle a horse, and such thing led to, well, not goodness on his end.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Well, it's an icky question, because on the one hand, my visceral reaction is, ew, and you shouldn't be doing this. From a point of view of, like, sort of everything goes sort of libertarianism, I guess you could say, well...
Well, I think one of the things that plays into this, and where it's probably quite different there than it would be here, because some of your things, well, you know, they're animal vectors and that sort of thing. Well, okay, because if it wasn't legal, then, and we were making it illegal, then there's these unknowns. But because it's been legal in Germany for at least, 50 years now? 40 years? 40 years.
Yeah, about that.
And there have been no raging epidemics of horse herpes or anything like that.
Yeah.
And the fact that it is still legal in a lot of other countries, and we have to assume that it's going on, that harm factor, that although is a valid point to bring out, doesn't seem to be. And then we're back to the whole sort of social ickiness. I guess in a way, maybe it's like a really amplified version of, we eat cow, but we don't eat horse. You know?
Yeah.
Like there are some things that are, and again, I feel weird defending this particular, because I mean, I'm not saying, ooh, you know, I want to have me a little piece of that tail, I guess. In the same sense that I wouldn't mind trying horse meat versus beef, right? I mean, I'd be much more willing to do one than the other. So, I mean, I'm not making a moral equivalence, but I think that's the issue there, is that in this particular thing, there is a sense of morality involved, but I don't know if it can be justified other than tradition.
Yeah, I do think that the consent issue is big. I don't believe that you can get consent from an animal to have sex with it. I think that that's kind of reaching.
But okay. And I went down this road too, but that leads to another slippery slope, is if it has the capacity for consent, because in order for it to have this argument, you have to say it has the capacity to consent, then you have to gift it a certain level of consciousness. And then if you live gifted that sense of consciousness, then as you mentioned, vegans suddenly say, hey, hi guys, we've been saying this all along. And so that leads to another uncomfortable thing of granting animals maybe more rights than we are actually comfortable doing because of that aspect.
Well, I mean, it's always been a difficult question, the whole animal rights aspect. I mean, most of us would agree that we probably shouldn't be, you know, experimenting with, like, cosmetics and dangerous chemicals on animals. That seems pretty cruel. Most of us agree that if we're going to consume animals, we should try to do it in a way that we're not, like, torturing them before we do it. So I think that we can come to the conclusion that we can minimize our our imposition on animals to a certain extent. Now, that being said, like I said, I'm sympathetic to the argument of vegetarians and vegans, even though I'm not a vegetarian or a vegan. But if the unanimous petition came about that it is cruel to eat animals and we're going to stop, I wouldn't complain that much.
True, but again, you're using the harm argument, which we've already dealt with. Because, I mean...
I think it's pretty obvious that it's harming animals to eat them.
Oh, true. But it isn't necessarily harming animals to, you know, bonk, bonk, bonk.
But I don't know. I think it probably could harm animals pretty badly.
Well, see, and this goes into another thing, because a lot of people would also use the idea of consent is to people who are mentally not up to par, or to children, which we often say can't really give consent. But for them, a lot of the harm that's done to them isn't in the act itself. In fact, most cases of that sort of stuff, it's not a bad thing in and of itself. But there are the emotional scars that are left afterwards. But those emotional scars usually come about because of society's reaction to them. For example, I mean, one of the reasons why rape is so horrific is that society, not meaning to, but quite often, marks a raped woman as somehow damaged and soiled and evil. And that adds to the whole trauma of the actual act itself. Whereas, I don't think you'd get that. I mean, I don't think your pig would care whether or not everyone thought it was a slut.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's an iffy question.
Well, you know, I don't think I've convinced Ethan yet to, you know, go down that road. And honestly, neither am I. But if we have any zoophiles out there in our listening audience, I'd be really interested to hear from you to find out what's your take, what's your defense, and how do you feel about this issue? It could be quite interesting. And anonymity can be maintained if you wish.
Mm-hmm.
We do live in a judgmental society. And speaking of judging, are you organic or not? Find out when we come back from this break.
Hi, we're Roused by Nature.
And you're listening to
CITR 101.9, broadcasting from Vancouver, British Columbia.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, the big question on everyone's mind is, what makes organic food?
Well, you know, I'm happy to announce that I think Radio Free Thinker could, for a small fee, be certified as an organic podcast and radio show. Typically, when you think of organic foods are usually was something that we think of as not involving modern synthetic inputs such as synthetic pesticides, chemical fertilizer. Often the foods also expand to not having things like industrial solvents or any kind of food additives into them. But technically, what makes food organic? Regulations, monitoring, and corporations behind organic food. And I don't mean corporations in the evil sense here, but just it's a business. So we've talked on the show about the facts and fallacies of organic food, but I thought it might be interesting to check into what actually qualifies as organic. To be scientific, one, of course, should start out with a standard definition. So to that end, I've used the legal definition stipulated in the Organic Product Regulations Act of 2009. Ironically enough, it doesn't actually define what organic is in the act. These regulations sort of have two main parts and a secondary but crucial sort of role for a third part. The regulations set out to establish a conformity verification board. These are the people who assess, recommend for accreditation and monitoring certification bodies. Certification bodies have been accredited by the said agencies and can certify products as organic. I mean, it kind of seems like we have a regulation, then we have a body, then we have another body, and then we have the farm. It seemed kind of really overly complicated. But the regulations do not specify in themselves, like I say, what is organic or what is not organic. And that actually goes to a third group. What it does establish is that one group gets to accredit another group. I'm gonna walk it backwards. It's easier to understand this way. So if you walk into a supermarket and you see a big sign that says organic cabbage or something, then you notice on the cabbage there's a little Canada Organic logo certifying it to be organic. That label was created and given out by a certification body to the farmer. That body gets the right to certify by another body called the Conformity Verification Body, which essentially says that this company is allowed to say that that company produced an organic product. Okay, again, kind of convoluted, especially for like a local producer who has to go through all these hoops. But what do the actual regulations say about what is organic? Well, the Regulations Act itself, as I say, it's only about 10 pages long. It doesn't really say much about organics itself. But out of that, you get a more formal set of regulations, which are in a different document, the Organic Product Specification Regulations. And that, just for example, a permitted substance section is like over 20 pages. So it's actually quite a lot to go through. So I looked at the regulations themselves, actually in the Act, and first off I noticed is that there's a section titled Determination of Percentage of Organic Product. That is, when you buy an organic product, it isn't necessarily 100% organic. The actually regulations state that up to 5% of something can be non-organic will still be labeled as organic, and you can have the idea of made with organic ingredients, and there's actually no real effective regulation over that. Now, you would expect, like I say, the Act to explain organic. That is left to the Canadian General Standards Board Committee on Organic Agriculture, which is composed largely of people in the business of organics, and it sets up this organic standards, which, of course, you know, it's kind of like you having them policing themselves. I mean, it's a group of organics who determine, do we meet the organic standards? Well, there are our own standards that we're meeting. Now, I'm not going to bore you with the details, but I did find some interesting things in there. Like, for example, there's a provision for emergency pest or disease treatment, which strikes me as a pretty large loophole. I found that, you know, that you could put through, right? I mean, is it an emergency or not? How do you determine that sort of thing? I also found that there's a bunch of substances on the permitted list that don't sound very organic to me. For example, synthetic ascorbic acid, calcium phosphate, magnesium chloride, which is just a salt, but still, sodium tetraborate, borax for another, and there's a lot of other sort of non-organic products on there. That said, I could also not help but notice that there were a number of items listed as acceptable additives that were sort of non-synthetic versions of synthetic compounds. So I mean, it's not like you're banning the compound itself, just the method to which it was produced. One example is ethyl alcohol or ethanol, or what we call booze. The synthetic, non-synthetic kinds are allowed, whereas the synthetic ones are not. But of course, what's the difference between them? And nothing. I mean, ethanol is by definition the same thing either way. It's a very defined chemical compound.
Of course.
Now, an argument could be made that one method of producing ethanol is from petroleum, and that's kind of harmful to the environment. Okay. Maybe it's a little worse than fermentation, which is the organic way of producing ethanol. But that said, a third way that would still be counted as organic, but isn't really, is cellulose method, where you basically take genetically modified bugs under very unnatural conditions that turn wood into alcohol. And because everything is sort of in the approved list, that would qualify. So that's sort of the technical side of stuff. And of course, nothing's perfect in the world, and neither is it going to be with organic labeling. Well, we've already discussed that there is sort of on the show that there's like an absence of health benefit for organics. And so in that sense, I think that organics itself is kind of false advertising. But there are other issues that are often ignored by the sort of pro-organic side. Now, I don't think any of these are necessarily fatal to the idea of organics, but something people who are sort of progressive or the liberal types should keep in mind when they start saying, hey, organics are always good. First of all, is the idea that, I mean, organics is a big, big business. In the U.S., it's almost $30 billion. In Canada, it's $2 billion, and it's doubled in the last 5 years. In fact, and I was stunned to find this out, and I hope it's verifiable, that over a quarter of what BC shoppers buy is organic product. Do you buy organics?
I do actually have a couple organic products that I buy, but I could care less how they were made. I just buy them because they taste better.
Ethan.
No, this is not the placebo effect. This is actually, I've bought, one of them is apple juice, and there's this brand that's organic apple juice, and compared to, say, I don't know, some other kind. And I've tasted them both. One of them clearly tastes differently, and it happens to be the organic one. I don't know if it's because it's organic or they just use different ingredients. Either way, I like the taste better. But it has nothing to do with whether or not it's organic or something. It's just because it tastes different.
Well, one could be from a concentrate and the other not. That would be a physical difference between the two. Now, one of the differences, how much was your organic apple juice?
It's actually not that more expensive than the crap kind, but it's I don't know, maybe like 10-15% more.
Which goes in line with what it should be. Because, I mean, ironically enough, one of the things people often think about is, you know, if you go organic, it's much, much more expensive. But actually, organics in themselves are actually a lot more profitable than non-organics. They're not really struggling to keep alive. Although organic yields may be lower than conventionals, they're only looking at about a loss of about anywhere from 10-30%. So not a huge amount. And there's a huge plus to it, because not only do you sort of have a lower yields, you also have lower costs, because again, you're not buying a lot of the synthetic fertilizer, herbicides, and antibiotics. Thusly, actually, for small farms, the extra cost or the organic premium is not actually that much. And then, of course, you look at the price of some of the stuff that they sell. For again, example, organic cauliflower, I priced out is like $4.79 versus the conventional one, which was $1.79. I had a friend of mine who bought a head of cabbage, and it cost him like $5. And I'm going, that should have cost you like 30 cents. Cabbage is real cheap, right?
Yeah.
So you have this built-in sort of
inflation, basically.
Inflation, that's it. And it's a false inflation, because again, it's not like it really bears out on the fact. And corporations have figured this out, because actually most organics are produced by multinational corporations. So Coca-Cola, Cargill, ConAgra, General Mills, Kraft, M&M Bars, these are major producers of organic foods. Of course, they don't actually use their own name for this. For example, Bare Naked, Wholesome and Hearty, Cashew are actually owned by Kellogg's. And that leads into another aspect of this, is that it's a big business. And we say, well, you know, we want to support local small farms and they're less harmful to the environment. But corporations like Cargill, they actually do organics on an industrial scale. And it's actually the industrial scale that is the problem. Now, we go back to the prohibited and not prohibited list that I briefly mentioned earlier. They use fertilizers and they have, you know, pesticides. They just use organic versions of them, but they're still spraying them on the fields. They're still dissipating them. They're still burning the fossil fuels or on the tractors and that sort of thing. So it's organics is not often what people think. I think more people, when they think of organic, should be thinking more local. And in BC, I'm not even sure if that quite qualifies, because we have some major producers here in our mainland.
Well, I mean, it's funny because I don't see how anyone can blame Coca-Cola, because if I was a corporation and they told me, hey, listen, you can sell someone the basically the same product and charge them three times as much and they will gladly buy it, I'd be like, really? Sure. Fine. If slapping an organic sticker on this makes you spend more money and you're okay with that, I will do that, sure.
Because it's funny, because like I say, a lot of Coke's products would be the organic juices or organic soda pop. And I'm going, well, soda pop is not organic.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, carbonated water, maybe there are some springs where you can kind of get natural carbonation, but it's soda pop. How can it be? You know, it's made with genuine cane sugar. As opposed to, I mean, sugar is sugar. It's one of those chemical things, right? Ironically enough, because as I say, when most of us think of organic, we think of the small farmer, right, who takes cares about the cow. And when he, after he makes love to it and then he kills it, you know, he actually, you know, he cares about it. So you get a better, if not even quality of food, you feel better for the environment that you've done it. But there's actually a big cost to getting certified. And that in itself is a big business. As I mentioned, there's like certifying bodies that certify bodies to certify products. And for example, I checked out one, ProCert, and I calculated for a typical farm of about 800 acres, it would initially cost them $1,200 to get certified and an annual cost of about $1,000. And these are farms that are making like $30,000 to maybe $100,000 if they're lucky a year. So that's a bit of money to dice out. And then you're trying to compete with your local organic products with the Cargills of the world, who not only are sort of producing quote unquote the same product, but they have all the big marketing. It's like someone who's trying to produce locally produced beer. I mean, sure, you're going to get a market, but you're not going to be competing with Molson's or whoever makes beer anymore.
Well, the other thing too is because for the small farmer, organics, organic produce requires more time and the yield is less. So they are producing less product. They sell it at a markup, but you're right. They're competing in with companies that have transitioned into entire fields of organic food. So they're maximizing production, even though they're dealing with a low yield product. So it does actually, I think, hinder the organic local farmer to choose to go organic than, say, just grow your regular cabbage or whatever and sell them.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you take a look at the Safeways where they've got, you know, aisle upon aisle of organic carrots, I'm going, well, those are not made by Bob's Farm. Those are made in the same one as the carrots right next to them that are non-organic with, again, a bit of different paperwork because the sourcing is a bit different on the fertilizer you used. But that leads into the other thing, and you're hitting very strongly at it, is that because, you know, organic has now become sort of a profit motive, the term organic itself is being manipulated and watered down in such a way as to have none of its sort of original naturalistic sort of ideal. In fact, I was reading about one company that managed to get tap water certified as organic, which, again, I guess in a way it is because it's water, so I mean, I'm not going to be hypocritical, but then again, no, it's not organic in the way everyone thinks. It's just tap water, right?
Well, that's the other thing. I hate the term organic because it doesn't mean anything. Everything is organic. Everything on this planet, except for like a couple of things that we've built in a lab, are organic. I mean, like, what do you think food is made of? Cement? Like, it is grown in the ground. It blooms. It comes out. It's got cells inside. You can take it apart. It's organic. So stop calling it organic. Call it something else. Call it, you know, expensive food if you have to. But this ludicrous notion that, like, because your food has been treated with pesticides to keep, like, malaria-infested mosquitoes off it, it's, like, going to poison you? No, 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 no. You can't do this. You can't just claim this scientific high ground for nonsense like this. I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing that alternative medicine is doing, where, you know, the big drug companies have realized, oh, so you're willing to pay an extra 15% if I slap the word alternative or herbal or
holistic.
Yeah, sure, they'll go for that. If somebody's willing to pay more money for the same product, of course they're going to say yes. And of course they're going to put behind their marketing and their ability to convince the public that this is going to, you know, do them better than a standard over-the-counter Tylenol pill or something. I mean, we really need to ramp up the critical thinking on this.
Well, and this goes back to, as I say, you know, the regulations themselves are quite convoluted in how they're formed. And the people who say what qualifies as organic are largely the same people who are in the industry. So for even those people who are purists in the organic movement, and as Ethan points out, you know, you're tilting at windmills, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
Because maybe you've got a point about certain pesticides may not be good, if not for you to eat, but for farm workers. Okay, then focus your energy on the pesticide and not sit there and create this magical label which, because of political lobbying and mass marketing, doesn't even mean what you think it means, even if it did mean that in the beginning. And focus your efforts on battles that you can win and that actually have some substance to them.
Yeah.
Right?
And stop trying to, like, we need to really stop this farce that organic farming is better for the environment. It's not better for the environment. It's making things a lot worse because if you are trying to feed a population of starving people, like, say, Africa, and you want them to grow food, then stop, like, forcing organic food down their throat. Let them build GM foods. Let them use pesticides so that their food can survive harsh climate and desertification, which is happening in these places. And, you know, start protesting the European Union, which is forcing all these tariffs on non-organic foods. You know, it's pretty easy for Prince Charles to sit there, oh, I didn't want to eat it, GM food. Well, you tough it up, you know, Prince, because there's people who are starving to death because of this fetishization of the word organic. It's stupid. It has to stop.
Well, and as you pointed out, and I mean, we can go down this maybe too far, but, you know, so you say, let's go organic, and you get 30% less yield. That means you actually have to put under cultivation 30% more ground, which actually means, as Ethan's kind of pointing, you're actually doing more harm. And as you point out, it's the fetishization of organic. I mean, natural substances are arsenic. Natural substances are botulism. I mean, those are natural and organic substances. Does not necessarily mean they're good for you. Now, because we're dealing with the type of thing, if you're for some particular regulations about item A, B, or C, sure, if there's a reason that you think we should not be using DDT, great. Make that your battle. Not sit there and say, okay, anything that isn't found in nature is bad and therefore is equivalent to DDT is crazy talk.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it surprises me when I hear people, skeptics, say, yeah, I'm fine give me that vaccination, but don't give me any GM foods. I want my produce covered in malaria and Ebola because that's natural. Like, seriously? Anyway.
Where do you buy your food again?
Where do I buy my food? Oh, I grow it in my backyard.
Oh, that's why it has all the Ebola.
Yeah. Well, that's my rant for today. We're running out of time. Why don't we go to one last quick commercial break and we'll come back with our skeptical highlights.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So we're wrapping up for today's show. Let's go into our skeptical highlights.
So I've got one. It's a talk, The Biology of Consciousness. It's this Friday, December 7th at 3 p.m. at the SFU Theater at the Burnaby campus. Speaker will be Dr. Christoph Koch, cognitive and behavioral biologist. And the blurb about it, it's free, by the way, it's free. You should go, it's free. Scientists seek to understand how subjective phenomenal consciousness sensations emerge from highly organized brain matter. Dr. Koch will summarize what is known about the anatomy and physiology of consciousness, outline the limits of our knowledge, and describe ongoing experiments in human, monkeys, mice, and to seek their characteristics of neural correlations with consciousness. He will also describe the most promising theoretical approach, in his opinion, grounded in circuit complexity information theory, and what it implies about consciousness in natural and synthetic systems. Which is quite good, because one, we can find out if they have consent. And two, I mean, again, we have this big thing about what is consciousness, and the more we look into it, the more nothing there is there to be there, but it's still there. You know, like, consciousness doesn't seem to be a thing you have. It's more of a collection of things and not a standard set of collections. And the idea of going into the neurology and the biology of it is quite important. In fact, that's one thing I like about the experimental method, because quite often philosophers, like myself, will sit in armchairs and pontificate and ignore what's actually been found out in the real world.
Very good. Okay, well, my skeptical highlights this week include the CFI Freethinkers Book Club, which is Saturday, December 8th at 1 p.m. at the Grind Coffee Shop. They're reading Denialism, How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives, by Michael Spector. And we'll have a link to that on our show notes. Of course, it is free, and you just go down there, buy yourself a cup of coffee, and discuss the book. If you haven't read it, don't worry. There's a TED Talk. You can watch that. And I believe that other podcast, the Skeptic's Guide to the something-something, once interviewed Michael Spector. I'm sure it's very fine. Go listen to it. Anyway, my next skeptical highlight is Cafe Inquiry, which is CFI's monthly discussion group. And the topic is Positive Thinking for Chronic Pain, Helpful or Harmful? This is Saturday, December 15th at 1 p.m. at SFU Harbor Center downtown in room 1505. The discussion is about positive thinking. Is it an effective treatment for chronic pain, or could positive thinking be detrimental to one's health? Again, we'll have all of these links on our show notes.
Good. You know, actually, it's something I forgot about to mention. Actually, a few things. One, people may not be aware of, but climate change talks are going on right now in Doha, which is ironic because one of the main causes of climate change is gasoline and petroleum, and Qatar, which is where it's being held, is actually the world's largest emitter per capita of greenhouse gases. Of course, that's largely due to the fact that they're a petroleum-producing nation, and they have a rather small population, but there is some irony to that. Hmm. And these ones are a bit more important than some of the other ones we may have covered in the past, because this also marks where the actual Kyoto Agreement, which we've been sort of living under informally, comes to an end. And there is now no sort of global agreement on what to do about climate change. And Lord knows, we've already talked about on the show that we're losing food every day. We're going to be starving to death because it'll be all gone.
No more Twinkies.
No more Twinkies. Another thing that I thought was interesting that I'm just going to mention sort of in passing is people may or may not have heard, but the state of Palestine gained observer status at the UN. Now, previously, Palestine was seen more as had observer status, but it was more like an organization, sort of equivalent to
the Red Cross or something like that.
Red Cross or something. But now it's been elevated to actual sort of statehood. It's not a member state, but it's an observer state. So it's more akin to the Vatican or Andorra. There's a few other nations that are sort of in that category. So this also gives them some extra rights as far as being on the UN, because they're now considered a state. So they can take countries to the international court if they violate laws, which, of course, is one thing Israel is really fearful of because it's been one of the major movers against it. Sadly, Canada's own government voted against it, which is a bit of a reversal of our policy. Canada had been, by and large, supportive of Palestinian statehood, with some caveats, of course, until the Harper government was elected, and then it's been like, Israel right or wrong, and Palestinians are evil terrorists. And on that, just because it gets very, very complicated sometimes, and there's some really viciousness in this. Once the vote had passed in the UN, giving Palestine this sort of semi-statehood, the Israeli Knesset passed, I don't think it was the Knesset that did it, but an arm of the Israeli government did building plans, what's called the E1 project, which essentially cuts off North and South West Bank from each other. So essentially now Israel has even prevented the physical formation of a Palestinian state, at least in the West Bank. And on top of that, they have they've also sorry, there's a phone call in here. We can't answer it. So I'll be quick so we can go off to our commercial. The Israeli government is withholding $100 and some odd million of taxes that they've earned, that they collected. Because, I mean, the West Bank is under Israeli control, so any tariffs or duties going in and out is actually collected by Israel and then given to Palestine. And they said, well, no, if you're going to go for statehood, screw it. We're going to keep your money, which, again, strikes me as really dickish to sort of do.
Yeah, I think it's actually an interesting thing to mention because it could be a really interesting option for us to talk about on the show. And if anyone has, I know people have opinions on this, so let us know what you think, because Don brought up an interesting point. Canada reversed its position, and there's different reasons we can posit. I mean, we were talking before the show about what could motivate us to do that. So I'm interested to hear what our listeners have to think. Email us at info@radioforthinker.com. Tweet us at CITRRFT. Let us know your thoughts, and we'll dive into this in the future. Well, I mean, we're out of time. It's terrible. Yes. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on, and fight open.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.